We got calls from newspapers in Czechoslovakia, news stations from Australia, New York City. I don't know, news stations.
On April 17th, Barbara Schisler was answering calls from around the world, pretty much from everywhere.
Yeah, just everywhere. It was, and I'm trying to talk to these people, and there are sirens going by, and all these first responders. Amazing how many first responders we had from surrounding communities. And because there was no one else to call, it was 8 o'clock at night, a little after eight, so they knew of us and they wanted to get the scoop and thought that we could give it to them. I don't know how helpful we were, but we did the best we could.
If you'd heard of the town of West before the West Fertilizer Company plant exploded in April of this year, there are a couple of likely reasons why. There's the annual West Fest, a celebration of Czech culture, a big deal in this town of less than 3,000 people. Then there's the Czech Stop, part bakery, part gas station, sitting right on Interstate 35, ready to feed hungry motorists heading toward Dallas or Austin with Czech pastries known as kolaches. And they're open 24 hours. So when the news stations around the world wanted to know about the explosion that rocked the tiny town of West Texas minutes after it happened, they called the place that was still open. They called Czech Stop's president. They called Barbara.
No concrete information because the local police and the firefighters, the injured people that came by because we were the only place open, for water or ice or whatever, some kind of help. Didn't really know what was happening, and they were in shock too. I remember one lady was in her truck and she had an injury on her leg, and there was a friend assisting her, and she asked if I would take off her shoe, and there was blood running down her leg.
The explosion killed 15 people, including 12 first responders, rushing to put out the fire that caused the blast. Five of them were from the West Volunteer Fire Department. Nearly 200 people were injured. An apartment building and a nursing home were leveled, schools, a park. The town was without running water for days after the blast, and it was weeks before people could venture into the northern part of town, hit hardest by the explosion, and see what was left of their homes.
It was something that a little town this size, you don't prepare for it. How can you? You just can't. And who would have thought it would happen? No one, It's just crazy.
Barbara said she felt the Czech Stop was the least affected by the blast and most capable of helping, so.
For 3 days, we fed everybody, and there were thousands of people, the injured, the homeless, the responders, the people that were here just trying to clean up. I think somebody said that they needed food for 3,000 people. So we cleaned out our freezers of our frozen kolaches, and we gave those. And water, of course, we have stockpile of water that we sell with our label on it. So that was all donated.
At one point, the Czech Stop was asked to bake kolaches for a few thousand people, which was a lot to handle. Instead, Czech Stop donated cases of sausage and other food and water.
It's one of those things where you just do what everybody asks because how do you say no? I mean, people wake up one morning and they've got their home and all of their belongings, and they go to bed that night and they've got nothing.
Eventually, Czech Stop started taking donations to help the town. I should mention, though, that they didn't actually ask for any donations. There wasn't a marketing campaign. Nothing went viral. They just set out plastic buckets labeled donations on their counters and taped a piece of paper to the front door to let folks know how much they'd raised. As of recording this, that number is more than $200,000. When Barbara told me that, I found it a little hard to swallow. So I asked if some of the donations that make up that $200,000 were perhaps very large checks from particularly affluent customers. She admits that there were a couple of checks for $1,000 or so. A couple. Then she smiles and says,
"We have the best customers in the world."
If you go to West, you hear a lot of stories like this one. Stories of people doing what they can to make a difference for their neighbors, to get things back to normal, or at least as close to normal as they can be. You're listening to an Observer Radio special, Recovery: West Texas Rebuilds. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. It's a marathon, not a sprint. You've heard me say this over and over since the explosion. Every month, West Mayor Tommy Mushka publishes a kind of informal newsletter on the city website, chronicling what's going on in town. He calls these Mayor Mushka's Minutes. The minutes you're hearing now are from August. Hundreds of agencies here from the very first day, helping us with our needs of shelter. As you may imagine, this monthly check-in with the citizens of West has become pretty important since the fertilizer plant explosion. Here, the mayor directly speaks to the people, letting them know about various services available for those in need and doing the crucial job of keeping morale up.
Well, it's a pretty good play on words, Mayor Mushka's Minute. So, no, I thought that when I became mayor, I did that from the get-go. And I thought the one thing that I could do was relate what's going on with everyone. And so I can kind of say, look, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. It seems to work. Everybody enjoys them. Everybody looks forward to him, so I'm going to keep it up.
Tommy Mushka has spent most of his life in West. He moved to the north part of town, the area hit hardest by the explosion, when he was 8 years old. When he's not busy being mayor, he works at Mushka Insurance, an agency he now owns, purchased from his father in 91. The people of West know him. Many have watched him grow up, and meeting with him in his office at the insurance agency, he seems much more like a guy you'd want to invite to a barbecue than a politician. So I'm not surprised when he tells me that many of the citizens have come to him individually to grieve and talk and just to vent after the tragedy.
I've had a lot of one-on-one. I mean, I've sat in here and we've cried together and we've tried to, you know, I'm the motivator. I guess I'm the cheerleader for the town. And you know, I'm telling them that it's going to be all right. It's hard. You know, a lot of these people, you know, have lost everything. And you know, they're just upset and they're nervous and they're displaced. And that combination just, you know, is very tough on any individual, much less an older individual. So I've had the opportunity to visit with a lot of them and hug them and just, you know, tell them that, you know, that it's going to be okay. And I truly, truly believe that with all my heart.
I met with Mayor Mushka a little more than 4 months after the explosion. Recovery was in full swing. You could visit parts of West and not know that anything had happened. But look close enough and you'd notice the occasional boarded window or a sign hanging in memorial for the first responders. In the north part of town, many houses too damaged to be repaired were already demolished, and construction was underway on other houses as well. In fact, just a couple hours after my meeting with him, Mayor Mushka met with representatives from FEMA to tour the lingering infrastructure problems, mostly sewer and water related, that needed to be addressed with federal dollars. I asked Mayor Mushka to walk me through step by step how the town got from the explosion to the current level of recovery. Here's what he said.
The explosion on April 17th changed this town. Changed the lives of the citizens in this town forever. I went to that explosion as a member of the fire department. You know, I delayed going there for whatever reason. I had a couple of things I did, so it took me a couple of minutes to get there. You know, if I would have been a couple of minutes earlier, I wouldn't be talking right now. You know, I was a block and a half away. I'd have probably been less than a block away. So I don't know what could have happened there. But as it turned out, you know, I was walking towards the explosion, the fertilizer plant, when it exploded. I immediately went back into my truck. And I don't know why I didn't go to the fertilizer plant. I still don't know why I did not, because I knew that there were firemen there, but I didn't. But I did, and I went back and started to be mayor and started, you know, starting to triage and so forth. So in the very beginning of the explosion, you know, we had things in motion that we learned about. We learned about this through the NEMS courses that mayors have to take on what happens in an emergency.
Offered through FEMA, NEMS, or the National Incident Management System, training courses are designed to help various agencies, including city government, deal with crises and emergencies.
You have to get your group together. You got to stay calm. You got to just focus on the task at hand. And that was, you know, first we got to mitigate the fires, suppress the fires with the equipment that we had. We had to go do search and rescue, which we did. And we went around, and then we had to evacuate the rest of the town, or at least half of that town. And so we did those in a chronicle order, in a very, you know, orderly fashion. We made sure everybody was out of that area and everybody was safe. Water, we had no utilities, we had no electricity, no water, no gas, no nothing. But we systematically again went in there with the help of other cities and other public works employees, got our water back up and running, got our utilities up and running, got our gas back up and running, and then eventually after a while, we allowed people to start coming back into the areas slowly from zones 1, 2, and then later on into zone 3, which was a few weeks after the actual explosion.
Oak Street runs roughly west to east through just about the center of town. If you leave Check Stop heading north on the feeder and turn right at the first major street you come to, that's Oak. Everything north of Oak was sectioned off into 3 separate zones. Zone 3 was the area furthest north and closest to the plant when it exploded. Zone 2 was a little less further away, less damage, and Zone 1 had even less. In September, when I did this interview with Mayor Mushka, the people living in Zones 1 and 2 were mostly back in their homes. Zone 3 was a different story. It was 2.5 weeks before people were so much as allowed back into Zone 3. And even then, it was for a precious few moments to grab what they could from the wreckage of their homes.
We still have a curfew and dusk to dawn in that area.
So nobody's allowed in Zone 3?
Not during the night. You know, there's a few people living there, mm-hmm. but due to the building and the possibility of someone coming in and stealing building materials, we thought it best to go ahead and quarter off that area at night. There's no reason to be there at night if you don't have to be there. If you're not living there, there's no reason to be there.
So how many people are living in Zone 3 now?
Of the 130 houses in Zone 3, probably 9. In various forms. Trailers, they're living in trailers while their houses are being fixed. One home has been completely, you know, demolished and built back up. 3 other homes have been, fixed, and the residents are now back in there. There's about 15 homes on various stages of construction, from the slab to the framing to the brickwork. In my neighborhood, I've got about 5 homes in my neighborhood that are all being repaired, and they're in various forms, various stages of repair. I should have mine finished in a couple of weeks.
But many West citizens were not as lucky.
A lot of people did not have enough insurance. They had some, didn't have enough. People have lost jobs, people have been injured and have, now unemployed because of their injuries. So there's a number of needs out there. It's a gauntlet of things that people need. Now, are there organizations that can meet those needs? Yes. Now that's what long-term recovery does, is they match you with an organization that may help you with that specific need.
After the fertilizer plant explosion, charitable donations started pouring into West. Many of them went to the Waco Foundation in nearby Waco, Texas. The $200,000 Check Stop raised, a lot of that money went to the Waco Foundation. Then in July, West was able to secure nonprofit status for their own foundation, the West Texas Foundation, and those funds were transferred over. The West Texas Foundation established West Long-Term Recovery, an assistance program that pairs people up with organizations that can meet their specific needs, ranging from big-name charitable organizations to local, church-based charities. Maybe you need house essentials like a new mattress or appliances. Maybe you need somebody to come cut your grass because you're injured and you can't do it yourself. Or maybe you're out of work, so you can't pay your rent.
So the Salvation Army may have rent money for you to pay your rent. Red Cross may have some other types of funds that will help you pay your utility bill. So that's what the long-term recovery does, is puts you in touch, puts the victim or the survivor, as we would call them, in touch with these various organizations that have monies that can be utilized for such a need.
It sounds like one hell of a job.
It is. And that's the thing about these people. These people don't only ever ask for anything. And right now is the time for them to ask. And it's hard. Sometimes it's hard for them to swallow that pride and say, look, I need some help. I need somebody to help me pick me up. And that's where the long-term recovery, and that's where the federal government comes into play. It's not very often that you have to ask for help, but in this situation they do, and that's what it's for.
We've never asked for anything in our life. You know, we're more the givers rather than the takers.
This is Joe Pajowski. He and his wife Carolyn used to live in the north part of town, Zone 3. Their house was mostly destroyed in the fertilizer plant blast and has since been demolished. These days, they're living temporarily in a house on the outskirts of town, lent to them by a friend, while they finish plans for a new house.
My age is 63, so I can't find a 2-year home loan anywhere. So I've asked SBA and all that, and they just don't have one. So the insurance money that we have is what we have to build with. And so we were kind of working on that, I'd say battling with on that, and so finally we're I think we're really, really close into where I think we're going to end up. So, you know, we know what we got. So we can go ahead and start with our house plans and with the money we've got. And that's what we've worked on our design about is what the money we have to work with. Probably going to. Got a couple of 2 or 3 years left to work, and beyond that, I couldn't have a home loan. So,
when the city let people back into Zone 3, Joe combed through what was left of his old place for anything worth salvaging.
We were fortunate enough to go through, peruse through our house, and pull out a lot of stuff. I'm sure there's stuff that got thrown away that we still not even aware of because of 8 inches of insulation and sheetrock all over the top of everything. You know, you just have to kind of dig through it to try to find out where everything was at. But and we did. We tried for the better part of 2 weeks before they finally demolished our house.
Joe shows me blueprints drawn up for the new place during our interview, and I can tell that losing his home and worrying about building a new one is wearing on him. But Joe and his wife lost much more than a house in the plant explosion. They also lost a son. Joey Pajovsky grew up in West. He worked as the city secretary. He was only 29 when he rushed to stop the fertilizer plant fire that would later cause an explosion and take his life. He was one of 5 first responders from West who died in the blast. Joey was married for a time, and he and his wife Lindsay gave birth to a boy named Parker. That was 5 years ago. Before his death, Joey filed for divorce from Lindsay and eventually won primary custody of Parker when Lindsay was caught selling drugs, Joe Pajovsky said. Now that he's gone, Parker's back under Lindsay's custody, though he spends multiple weekends per month with Joe and Carolyn. Their home is full of pictures of Joey and Parker. As we sit and talk at their dining table, a kid-sized four-wheeler a few feet away stands at the ready for its driver's return. It's easy to see that they dote on their grandson, which may explain why they were so eager to help him when one afternoon he had a really big idea.
We picked Parker up from school. It was on the last weekend in May, Memorial Weekend. I think the first stop is always to go by Sonic and get an ice cream, and we did that. And Carolyn asked him, what did he want to do? And he said that he wanted to go by our house and just see our house. Our house was destroyed, but it was actually still standing at that time. So he just wanted to go and see. So we drove down to the north end of town and stopped in our driveway. We got out of the car. He got out of the car and stood in the yard, just looked for a minute or so, and then he said he's ready to go. We got back in the car, and we started driving south, back south towards downtown West, and you kind of have to go by the old city park. That's what sparked his initial statement. And he was talking to Carolyn. He said, Gigi, I have a project that I'm going to do. And Carolyn said, well, what is that project, Parker? And he says, I want to rebuild the city park. I want to raise money to do that. We both kind of looked at each other and didn't say anything. And I said, well, Parker, is this a project that maybe is going on at school? And he said, no, people. He said, this is my project. Carolyn asked him, he said, well, what do you want to do to make the money? You want to sell t-shirts? And he said, no, I don't want to sell t-shirts. And she said, well, do you want to sell hamburgers? And he said, no, Gigi, I don't want to sell hamburgers. And he paused for a second and he said, I want to sell hot dogs. So we kind of talked about it just briefly and then we went on doing what we were going to do that day. About a week or so later, Carolyn and I had been talking about it off and on, and I said, you know, we need to ask Parker one more time if that's really his thought or his idea, his dream or whatever you want to call it. So that night we asked, Carolyn asked him again, said, Parker, do you want to still sell hot dogs to raise money for the city park? And he said, yes. He said, that's my project.
Parker, like all little kids, enjoyed playing at the park, but it might have meant a little more to him than most because his father, as city secretary, had a hand in drawing up renovation plans for the park, plans that had not been enacted before due to a lack of funds. The Pajovskys really wanted to make this dream a reality for their grandson, but they knew they were going to need a little help. They found a little more than that. They found a posse. Tell me about the Reagan Street Posse.
Oh, the Reagan Street Posse. There's so much you could say.
This is Joey Kohler. Joey grew up with Parker's dad and a tight-knit group of friends, or maybe cohorts in mischief, called the Reagan Street Posse, named for a street running through the north part of West on which most but not all of the posse members lived.
There were probably about 25, and I know this is a big number that's going to vary, but between 25 and 40 kids, all within 3 to 8 years of age. We all had older siblings, younger siblings, and we raised a lot of chaos in the neighborhood. But that was before electronics were really big, so we were always outside doing something. During the day, it was always something proactive, like playing football in the front yard, playing basketball, at the park, swimming in the old principal's pool whenever he didn't know about it. That probably was not one of the better things to do, but we just found ways to be active and be outside all together.
After the fertilizer plant explosion, Joey and a few other members organized a Reagan Street Posse reunion at Knorr's Sausage and Burger House in downtown West. More than 100 people showed up, including parents of posse members, all of them eager to do something for their hometown.
That was one of the big things, is we were trying to figure out what we could do to try to help that area, just because we know all of our families were, at the time homeless, and some had lost loved ones, and, we all lost a big part of us, being that Joey was one of the firefighters. And so we were trying to figure out what we could do to help out in any way possible.
I told Parker's story at that meeting, at that reunion, and they jumped all over it. Reagan Street Posse jumped all over it and said, we want to help. We want to be a part of this, We all played at this park too, and it's something we can give back to our city. So that group, with the addition of a couple of two or three other key people, started planning the hot dog benefit.
Once Joe had brought up the idea that Parker had, and he said that we're going to do it, we're going to sell hot dogs, that was something that all of us on the RSP, on the Reagan Street Posse, felt very energized about doing and making that something that we wanted to have happen. So that was one of our priorities. And the support, not only from the RSP, but with all of our connections, our networks, our community, once everybody got wind of the actual story with Parker, it caught on like a wildfire.
So here's the Pajovskis' original plan. They'd sell a few hundred hot dogs. There'd be chips and soda. They'd sell some baked goods, maybe. They'd set up a silent auction. Basically, they'd try to make as much money as they could and turn it over to the town earmarked specifically for rebuilding the park. Mission accomplished. But it became apparent very quickly that interest in their humble plan was much, much greater than they anticipated. The Reagan Street Posse formed the Parker's Park Project. They created a logo with Parker and his dad, dressed in firefighting gear and silhouette. They started making t-shirts and built a website. Things were coming together.
My wife and I, we asked Joe about putting it in, we asked Joe and Carolyn if it was okay to put it on Facebook after they put it in West News. And they said yes. The next thing you know, within I think it was 3 to 4 days, we had over 1,000 likes. Well, within another week, we were at over 2,000 likes. We had reached 26,000 people, and I want to say it was in 27 or 28 different countries. That's whenever we started realizing that we were talking, hey, Joe, we may need to up the ante on the hot dogs and go a little bit more.
I think the hits on Facebook was probably the initial eye-opener. But even going into Saturday morning, I wasn't sure of exactly how many people were going to show up. It was scheduled to start at 10:30. There was people showing up around 9 o'clock to help. By 10:30, the grounds were full. And they stayed, too. They stayed. It doesn't appear that anybody left. They came at 10:30. 2:30, 3 o'clock, the grounds were still full. They stayed.
West's volunteer fire department served the hot dogs at the benefit, and they served the better part of 3,000 hot dogs that day. There were 2 moon bounces, a bake sale, and a silent auction. The lawn at West City Hall was full of town residents, of course, but the Pajovskis estimate that 3/4 of the people buying hot dogs that day came from other parts of Texas. Hot dogs were $5 a pop, but a few generous people insisted on spending a little more on lunch that day.
For instance, there was a company, Shermco is the name of the company, and it is a electrical maintenance company. Well, anyway, the night before, my brother called me and said that these guys are going to be down here tomorrow. They want to donate some money. And I said, well, that's cool. You know, well, there'll be people here that'll accept their donations. He said, no, you don't understand. They want to donate a lot of money. And I said, okay. I'm not even having an idea of what a lot of money is at that point in time. But the next morning we heard whenever they started showing up, and there was probably about 12 of them, from the CEO of the company to the human resource manager to other key people. They orchestrated a deal to buy hot dogs from Parker. And so they got us all together in one spot. And the CEO said, Parker, I want to buy a hot dog, and I'll give you $2,000 for it. So they had what they had was a stack of $500 Visa cards. Each card had $500 on it. And before each one of those employees got done, they handed over $20,500. Each person was doing it one by one, and they were either giving them four or three cards, so $1,500, $2,000, whatever the case might be. And so the first three or four cards he stuck down in his pocket and said, you know, I guess he said, cool, you know, and he stuck it in his pocket. Well, anyway, after they kept coming and they kept coming and they kept coming, well, I took the cards out of his pocket and I put them in my hand. So whenever all of them got through, there was probably a 5-inch stack of these cards, totaling up to, you know, how many cards is 20,500 divided by 500, you know. But so it was, like I said, it was very impressive. And people like that, you know, it's just amazing.
The most incredible thing was at the end of the event, we were sitting around talking about what was taking so long to do the money count. And so we were like, man, we didn't realize it was going to be, you know, as much as it was. We were just kind of talking, what do you think? And we were like, oh, you know, maybe 30,000 or so, because we knew we had the $20,000 donation from Sure & Co. So we were thinking, no, 30 to 40,000. And so afterwards, we all get back over here. And Tim, who's a CPA, he's been kind of doing the logistics of the finances. He gets back over here. He says, all right, we have everybody together, so we want to kind of sit down. And that's when we find out that we made the $83,000 on that event. And of course, then the sentimental meaning came in, because we all knew that Joey was born on 8/3/83. At 8/03, I didn't know that part at the 8/03 or at the weighing 8/3, but I knew he was 8/3/83. And so to us, that just shows that he was definitely there with us. And I think he had a big hand in the success that we had.
When they said 83,000, we just looked at each other.
This is Carolyn Pajowski.
Joey was born August the 3rd, 1983. He weighed 8 pounds and 3 ounces. He was born at 8:03. So we have no doubt that he had a hand in this, and that was a sign that it was a success, and he was there behind it, and everybody could feel, I don't know, they just said it was kind of a uplifting, I don't know how to say it, but everybody was happy there, and everybody knew, you know, no doubt that Joey was there, and Parker had a blast.
Parker has big plans for the new park. He wants a fire truck with a water fountain and a large gazebo for throwing parties. In addition to monetary donations, Parker's park project has received new playground equipment, splash pads, and pledge services like landscaping. The idea is to have the playground section of the new park, the section that the money raised by the Parker's Park project will apply to, finished by April 17th, 2014, the first anniversary of the fertilizer plant explosion.
It was just an awesome feeling to see that little boy's idea turned into that.
And what it turned into was more than just a playground or some swings. It turned into an idea that a community rallied behind at a time when what they really needed was something to rally behind, a reminder that things get better. But I think Joey Kohler and his wife Rose say it best.
Everybody here, we basically are a large family. And so for us to be able to, in the face of adversity, do what we did and handle what we've handled the way we have, we're going to continue to get bigger, get better, get stronger as a large family. And so ultimately it comes back to just thanking everybody who is either involved, participated, showed up, donated. Even if they couldn't donate it, they just thought about us. That's
positive feedback, encouragement, mm-hmm. prayers. I mean, everything. I mean, not just, like you said, not just monetary, just everybody's thoughts and prayers from everywhere, all over the state, all over the nation, all over the world. I mean, you know, West is its own community, but everybody knows somebody. I mean, everybody's just kind of hugged us. Like, the whole nation's hugged this little community, and it's phenomenal to receive this amount of support from all over.
Everybody sits around and asks why somebody else can't do something to solve a situation, whether it's like, you know, a church or, you know, a local government or something like that. And half the time we can just step outside our front door and do it ourselves.
I'm sitting in a loft in Dallas's Deep Ellum neighborhood. On a wall behind me is a t-shirt carefully hanging in front of some very expensive camera equipment. The shirt is black, and printed on it is the word I, and then a picture of a glistening, fruit-filled kolache. And underneath them both is the word West, I Kolache West, a locally focused take on designer Milton Glaser's iconic I Love New York t-shirt. And sitting with me, the shirt's creators, a couple of guys from Dallas.
My name is Ryan Sumner, and I guess I'm just a bartender here in Dallas.
My name is Nick Quintero, and I've been designing apparel for over 10 years. And I design all kinds of other stuff and pretty much anything creative that I can get my hands on.
Ryan and Nick don't have a direct connection to West. They weren't born or raised there, far from it. The closest tie they have is a near religious zeal for stopping by the check stop and eating kolaches on their way down I-35.
I always get strawberry. I'm very very minimalist. It's got the cream cheese on top, which is so good.
What do you get?
Well, I get the prune because that's what my grandma made. And my grandma made prune and sesame. And I think prune needs to get a lot more attention because it's actually very tasty and everybody associates it with old people. So anyways.
So no direct connection, unless pastries count. But after the fertilizer plant explosion, they both wanted to help West. And Ryan, he's got a little more than a passing interest in charity.
Like every fall, I head up a big Movember campaign.
Movember is a men's health awareness campaign and fundraising drive that involves growing mustaches in the month of November.
And my team has doubled its money every year, and that's like extremely important to me. And I was starting to think that I wanted to do like a spring fundraiser of some sort, like a spring charity. And even if it was just like, you know, $5,000, just do something small. And then suddenly this happened, and it was like, just woke me up and was like, you know what? I pass through there every time I'm headed down to Austin, every time I'm coming back, and everybody I know does it.
Ryan decided to print t-shirts and sell them to raise money for West. He'd priced them at $20, meaning that for every shirt sold, $14 or so would go to West after recouping printing costs. He even had an idea for the design. He just needed a little help in the art department. A mutual friend put Ryan in touch with Nick. Apparel is Nick's day job. He creates t-shirts and art for products sold in stores like Walmart, Target, Urban Outfitters. He's got a shirt with the slogan, "Whiskey While You Work," and he says the most recognizable thing he's done is a shirt featuring Darth Vader riding a motorcycle. Nick was boarding a plane heading back to Dallas after a business trip when he got Ryan's email. He got to work on Ryan's idea immediately, busting out a tablet and a stylus in a crowded plane.
It was the most uncomfortable experience ever because I'm sitting here in this tiny seat. I've got my laptop pushed as far back as I possibly can, and the person in front of me has their seat back, so my laptop is slightly closed. You know, the screen is at an angle, and I'm trying to draw at an angle and everything, and it was so bad. I mean, it was completely uncomfortable trying to draw in here in that space that I had, but, you know, I was able to get the design out and have it finished, and by the time we landed, you know, I shot him the first version of it.
While he was designing that shirt, I got to work on a website. So I'm setting up the online store, setting up the Tumblr, setting up the Twitter and the Facebook page, and just waiting for that image. And as soon as I got that image back from him, I just threw it up online, blasted it out everywhere I could, asked all my friends to blast it out. You know, Nick blasted it out, and we got the word out on pre-order. And the pre-order was awesome. Every 15 minutes, my phone was dinging from PayPal with an order, and it was just a really remarkable response. And not even, I mean, I was like, another text, oh, PayPal, you know, and it was just so encouraging and so uplifting to see that.
Ryan and Nick went from tossing a few t-shirt designs around and building a web presence to shipping their first orders in about a week.
I am a very, like, driven person, I guess, professionally, And I just started bartending 4 months ago, and I'm already have three great jobs, including a place I work in the day from 10 to 3. Then I go from 6 till 2 o'clock in the morning, and then I turn around and do it all over again. And so I have a 3-hour period between 3 o'clock p.m. and 6 o'clock p.m. where I can make this happen. And I really wish I had more time to dedicate to it, but, you know, even like I said, even if it was something little that I could do, is important to me.
Wait a minute. So you were doing all this in a span of 3 hours between your jobs?
More or less. Luckily, like Saturday, the crucial Saturday, I wasn't working when I was like talking to the screen printer and everything else. I didn't have to work till 10 p.m. that night. So if I was like a welder, I would have driven my welding truck down there and found something that I could weld to help people rebuild. I mean, you just got to find what you have like that's related to your lifestyle and that's organic for you, and don't force anything. And if you don't try to do something you're not good at, you'll actually, you know, you've got inertia in your life going in one direction. Get behind that inertia and push behind it.
Ryan also took the shirts to a benefit concert at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas called Texans for West, a benefit concert that, like the Iconoclasts West shirts, came together in record time thanks to a few dedicated folks who just wanted to do something. I met the three folks behind Texans for West at Good Friends Beer Garden and Burger House in Dallas, just as the restaurant was setting up for the day.
I'm Gavin Malloy, and I'm the marketing creative director at Granada Theater. I just remember waking up on like 9/11 morning and feeling like completely powerless and kind of in shock and that kind of, and then, you know, coming into work that morning, I didn't really even know what had happened. And, you know, seeing one of the girls that comes into work that's an intern there that showed up for her intern shift the day this happened, that she lost two of her family members, you know, it was just kind of like, hey, I want to do something. You know, I don't want to sit here and read all these news stories. And, you know, like that in, even with like the Boston bombings, that was something that, you know, all the pictures of people running to help, like that was kind of that type of attitude, I think. It was infectious amongst us.
Gavin puts on concerts for a living, so when the explosion happened, he did what he does best and started calling up band managers hoping to land someone to play a benefit. Like Nick and Ryan, a mutual friend hooked Gavin up with Matt Tobin, who was also calling around trying to find some musical talent for a West benefit of his own.
I'm Matt Tobin, and I'm one of the owners of Good Friend Beer Garden and Burger House in Dallas, Texas.
Before opening Good Friends, Matt worked in and managed music venues in Deep Ellum. Together, Matt and Gavin managed to round up a full bill of mostly Dallas bands, including Jonathan Tyler and the Northern Lights, the O's, and Baden Lewis of the Toadies.
I come from the water. I come from the water. I come from the water. I come from the water, yeah.
I know that whenever I was talking to people, I probably gave off the, you know, obviously you're going to help us with this, because why wouldn't you help us with, like, you know, basically, you know, if you say no, you're just, why would you even say no? Like, you better be in Tokyo if you're like, it's and I don't know that I really acted like meant to do that, but it was probably in my voice.
You know, the next logical step is, where are we going to do this? And I thought of every place that was around, you know, like, but also, where can we do this? And it's not going to cost us all of our profits, you know, that we wanted all the money to go, you know, somewhere good. And that was really the awesome thing, is just getting Becky involved. And then that took care of almost all the infrastructure.
I'm Becky Howard, and I'm talent buyer for the AT&T Performing Arts Center.
In addition to her day job, Becky is a musician who plays violin for Sarah Jaffe, The Crash That Took Me, and Betham. Becky managed to land Texans for West Strauss Square, part of the AT&T Performing Arts Center.
Literally, when she sent me an email saying we've gotten the space for free and everybody's donating their time, I was like, oh, haha, funny. You know, like, really waiting for, I was like, yeah, Becky and I'll joke around. So I was like, oh, cool, no, like, what's the cheap cost that we're going to get it at? And then, you know, that happening for free was just kind of like, wow, you know, that's awesome.
The benefit concert happened on April 28th, a mere 11 days after the plant explosion, and it was a massive success. More than 1,000 people showed up and paid the entrance fee of $20, all of which went to West. There were t-shirts for sale, including the Iconoclasts West shirt. They even had kolaches, dozens and dozens of them, driven up from the check stop. In total, Texans for West raised $39,000 and change. Roughly 85% went to the Fallen Firefighters Fund, with the remainder going to the West chapter of the Humane Society. And they picked those organizations in part because they were willing to let Texans for West direct where the money was spent.
I mean, I think people coming together and supporting each other is more dependable than government help. Just because there's a lot of bureaucracy and it's tough, and I know we learned a lot about government process in this with some certain organizations that you donate to as we were kind of discussing our options. Because their funds get dictated from a higher federal level. Once their amount of funds has been spent, even if you raise more than that, it just kind of goes back into a pool that's going to help other places, and that's good. But in this specific instance, who better to raise money for something like that than people that care about the place or the people or the memory or whatever you want to call it? I mean, I think that government help is nice and good, and we should have those systems in place, but I think that the type of thing we did, I think, helped quicker, probably. I could be wrong about that. Yeah.
I would think, yeah.
Ryan Sumner had similar concerns about where to send the money he raised selling I Kalachi West shirts.
If I give my money to something like the Red Cross, I love the Red Cross. It's one of my favorite organizations in the world, period. And it is non-sectarian and everything else. But they also have a lot of overhead and coverage costs that I feel like I want to give our donors as much of an impact as possible. And they're already giving $6 towards the cost of the shirts. And so if I donate to the Red Cross, that's taking off another maybe $2 or $3 from their donation. And so if I can just give it to the direct aid community, that's really important to me.
The Sunday after the explosion, Ryan went down to West to see if he could help out. He wound up just talking to people, letting them vent about what they'd experienced.
The good thing about that was being able to just talk to the people, like going to restaurants and stopping on the side of the road and just chatting with people and kind of understanding what they were going through. You know, I had some really poignant conversations with like some high school seniors, and that's where I got a lot of my information about what was happening with the schools and what happened that day. So there really is a lot of strength there, and you kind of see the... It doesn't matter who you are, people rise to the occasion and they do what's expected of them. And, you know, you must keep living. And that's the, you know, people say, like, they made the shirts that say, like, Boston Strong. And they're like, Boston's will get through this because they're strong. And, you know, like, in Moore, the whole tornado incident, you know, people are like, you know, we're going to get through this because we're Oklahomans. And that's all true. But I think the bottom line is, dude, we're people and we're human beings. And that's what we do. And we come together as a community and we help each other. And we're strong. We're much stronger than we give each other credit for. And when I I'm talking to a 17-year-old girl who was at her job as a waitress, the explosion happened and she was thrown on the floor and glass was shattered all around her, like, you know, she was in Baghdad or something. And she has two twin brothers who are in fifth grade, and their best friend's dad was split in two by debris. And she's just talking to me about it matter-of-factly and, you know, almost coldly, but you know that what she's doing is just suppressing everything that she's going through, you know. And they've been really strong and they've really risen to the occasion. And, you know, I'm so proud of those people. You know, just so proud of the, you know, just that little girl, just in seeing that strength in her. And I know that that's in each individual person throughout the community. So it's really admirable. It's really empowering. It's really hard to like talk to somebody going through that and then not help. You know, who would I be if I wasn't compelled to help in some way? So,
it's Labor Day weekend and West Fest is in full swing. The grounds are packed with people drinking beer from monstrous commemorative jugs and dancing to polka. There are deep-fried kolaches for sale because what festival would be complete without deep-fried everything? There's a midway complete with rides designed to make you throw up some of those kolaches, helicopter rides, carnival games, a mechanical bull. But there's not much acknowledging the plant explosion or the impact it's made on this tiny Texas town. The volunteer firefighters are handing out water and taking some donations. There's a sign on the arena where a washer pitching competition is heating up that honors and lists the names of the first responders who died. But that's pretty much it.
I'm looking forward to the whole festival as a whole, and I'm looking forward to it giving the people of West a sense of normal after our recent tragedy.
This is John Herdick, the president of West Fest's board of directors, a position he's held since 1981.
And hoping that they will come out and enjoy themselves and get a little taste of what their lives have been before and can work through their hardship.
I ask him if West Fest is any different this year in light of the tragic events in April.
We've tried not to make it that way. We've tried to make it, like I say, as much as normal as possible so that people can feel like that, you know, this is their home and this is part of it, and there is some normal in town.
The people of West need not look for reminders of the explosion. They're surrounded by them. In the neighborhoods rebuilding themselves, the landscape of a town permanently changed, and in the absent faces of those who were lost. But this year's West Fest was a chance to forget all of that, if only for a few precious polkas. One of the main draws of West Fest every year is a polka band called Brave Combo. The band started playing West Fest annually in 1979, the same year the band was founded, and they haven't missed one yet.
Saturday night in that pavilion is just bedlam.
This is one of the band's founding members, Carl Finch. He's seen every one of those shows, so I asked him if Brave Combo's performance at West Fest 2013 felt any different.
It's always bedlam, but it was definitely up a notch this year. Felt different because everybody's expectations were really high, and we were absolutely determined to make it the best party for all of our friends there that we could. You know, we wanted to make it the most up thing we could possibly do. I just felt a lot of responsibility to just be the most up and positive. And I made a couple of references, more than a couple, maybe three or four, but they were short and they were just supportive, you know. It wasn't maudlin, and that wasn't not going to be my role, and I think I would suck at that anyway.
I tell Carl what Mr. Hurtick had to say about creating a sense of normalcy, and he agrees.
Yeah, I definitely felt the same way, that, you know, this is, let's make this a party, period.
And that's what they did. Brave Combo had the whole of West Fest tucked underneath the main pavilion and polka-ing the night away, dancing and laughing as the band played a polka-fied cover of A-ha's Take on Me and the Hokey Pokey. The tragedy felt a little further away, like it could have been just another Saturday night at West Fest. Even though in many ways, and for many people, it wasn't. And that's kind of where West is right now. The recovery process is underway. West school kids are attending classes at home and no longer commuting to nearby towns. Repairs are being completed all over town. Slowly, the people of West are getting back to the way things were. Or maybe just learning to accept the way things are going to be from now on. This Observer Radio special was written and produced by Jonathan McNamara. It was edited by Dave Mann. A special thanks goes out to Rip, Corbidet, and Brave Combo for lending us some of the music you heard on this special. And of course, a big thanks goes to you for listening. For more information about West Texas, visit texasobserver.org. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.